Mr. Love, good morning to you. You may approach.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's George Love on behalf of the appellant in this case. On petition for further review, we've assigned two errors in from the court's appeal. One is the application of the civil pleading standard to the criminal standard of review, and the other, which flows from that, basically is a sufficiency of the evidence argument regarding the crime of carrying concealed weapon. Your Honor, our primary concern is the use by the Court of Appeals of a civil pleading standard overlaying, or which necessarily overlays the standard of review, limiting the criminal standard of review to only those facts which fit a particular theory. We believe that's just absolutely an opposite, in the sense that it's the evidence viewed most favorably to the state and supports a rational trier of facts conclusion that the crime was committed. The Court of Appeals decision was a split decision with Judge Pirtle dissenting, finding that sufficiency argument turned on, I think more precisely, the statutory phrase of concealed on or about the person, but more importantly is the court's case review on what immediate reach means within the meaning of the statute carrying concealed weapon. Again, as I stated in the brief, we think the primary error on the Court of Appeals is applying a civil pleading standard to a criminal standard, thereby modifying the criminal standard regardless of the evidence at trial. Now, I will certainly acknowledge on appeal, the court was concerned about the sufficiency of the evidence, and I pointed out to the Court of Appeals in oral argument that a rational trier of fact could have found Mr. Senn guilty of carrying a concealed weapon when he first drove onto the property. And I pointed out that there is evidence that the gun was in immediate reach from the two, shall I call them victims in a sense, of the gun, that he reached into the truck, and it was readily accessible, so that not only could he have been convicted of the concealed weapon charge based on the testimony or the evidence at the end of shooting at the victim allegedly and so on and so forth, but certainly at the beginning as well, when he first drove onto the property, pulled in the truck, grabbed the gun, and allegedly shot.
Counselor, are you saying that he couldn't have been found guilty then based on the evidence at the time of the stop?
I didn't hear the first part.
I hear you arguing only about the first part of the incident. Are you then conceding there should not be consideration of the evidence at the time of the stop?
I am not conceding that the basis of the vacation or the finding of the Court of Appeals is that the gun was not in his immediate reach while driving. That's the Court of Appeals conclusion based on this court's precedent that the gun has to be within immediate reach. So it really turns on
Does the statute or the case law limit it to driving? Does either the statute on possession or the case law defining possession inside of a vehicle limit it to just driving the vehicle?
No. And that's kind of the issue that the dissenting judge in the Court of Appeals pointed out. This court has never said that it has to be in immediate reach while driving. In other words, if it's in reach when he stops, or he could reach it when he stops, then the dissenting court or judge believed that that was violation of the statute, that it would be in immediate reach when he was stopped, if he could reach it. And the court pointed out, or the dissenting judge pointed out, that this court found a locked weapon in a glove compartment still within immediate reach, which in a locked glove compartment required a two-step process. So you could argue stopping the vehicle and them reaching over is a two-step process as well.
Would your, you argued that you could have obtained a conviction when he first, or could have, you could have been found carrying the concealed weapon when he first entered the property.
Correct.
Was there any more evidence other than the fact of the one witness's statement that it could have been under the seat, or it might have been under the seat, I don't know, it was in the U-Haul, easy to reach? Is that sufficient to sustain?
Well, there was also another testimony that he went back to the truck, opened the door, and the gun was within easy reach.
Well, that could have been on the front seat, couldn't it?
That's correct.
And that wouldn't be concealed.
I will concede that the finding of guilt there would be by inference. In other words, there's no direct evidence that, you know, that it wasn't in a locked case or anything like that. But
well, is might sufficient evidence to convict beyond a reasonable doubt?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is his determination that it might have been here, but I don't know?
Well, if the testimony was flat out, it was within easy reach. That is sufficient for a rational trier of fact.
Not if it's not concealed.
That's true. If it's laying open on the seat, you have State v. Hill, which is
that's not
in the open.
Okay.
But again, the issue, though, I guess the statutory interpretation that this court has to decide as a matter of law is what, and I think it's even more than concealed on or about the person, but what is the definition of immediate? Does that mean it has to be immediate at all times? Does it mean while if it's out of your reach while driving, it's not concealed? Does it mean stop and reach it? Is it concealed? That's the word immediate is, I think, what's going on here. In order to meet the statutory definition of concealed on or about the person. But again, the main concern is that we believe that the Court of Appeals overlaying that civil pleading standard onto the criminal standard of review is the main error.
Counsel, do the provisions of Section 28-1212 have any impact on our analysis?
The answer is that statute, if memory serves me correctly, is that the presence of a firearm in a vehicle is prima facie case such as showing possession. Well, in a criminal case, I think you have to be very, very careful about presumption, okay? And this court has said that the basic meaning of that statute is the evidence sufficient to go to the jury. Now, obviously, the trial court in this particular case felt that the testimony of the two victims, again, in quotes, in this particular case, was sufficient to submit it to the jury on whether or not it was concealed on or about his person. And as I argued, you know, there's no way that the police could have stopped the truck. In other words, there would have been no reasonable, articulable suspicion to stop the truck, and there was testimony that there was a shot and a gun in a truck. That precipitated the stop by the police officer subsequent search of the vehicle.
Well, how broad does this go that it has to be within easy reach of the driver? I mean, does that mean that you can't leave your hand from the steer? You have to have one hand on the wheel and be watching while you're reaching for your gun? Or is it the fact that the driver, if he leans over, can obtain control of the weapon?
That's precisely the question of law this court is being called upon to decide. In other words, I think it turns on the definition of what this court media is that is stated in the Sacramento case.
I mean, if the gun's in the back trunk of the U-Haul, it's not within the immediate.
That's range. Correct.
That allows people to carry weapons in their trunk.
Right. Yeah, you can carry a weapon in the cab of your vehicle. Don't hide it. State v. Hill, you're protected. You're not carrying a concealed weapon. When you attempt to hide it under the front seat, underneath clothes, as in this case, or a jacket or whatever it was underneath clothes, and so on and so forth, that's when you start raising the concealed part of the statute. Now, then, whether it's in immediate reach, it's the whole idea behind the concealed carry statute is so there isn't an opportunity in the temptation to use the weapon if confronted by another person. In other words, it's out in the open, everybody knows it's there, and they know there's a situation that you're in. That's, I think, the policy behind it. That answers your question. But we believe that the court feels erred in applying that civil pleading standard over the customary criminal statute with respect to the standard viewed most favorably to the state, because the evidence shows he could be convicted either when he first drove onto the property or if they accepted the fact that he pulled a gun off. With that, we'd ask you to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kolosch, good morning to you.
May it please the court. My name is Keith Kolosch, Kolosch Law Office. I'm here representing Josephson Jr. As far as what the state's issues are with this alternate theory of what happened at this farmstead, I think it's pretty clear that the jury in this case, who gives credibility to witnesses and gives them, as far as the credibility they give the witnesses, you can see that they did not give the state's witnesses very much credibility at all. If they did give any credibility to their witnesses, at the very least, Mr. Stenn would have also been convicted of terroristic threats. But you can see that they believed the testimony of Mr. Stenn, who said that he never retrieved a weapon from the vehicle, over the testimony of the state's witnesses. So this alternate theory, if you go down that path, it doesn't go anywhere. There's no way that the jury was going to sustain a conviction for carrying a concealed weapon with that using the facts that are presented at the farmstead.
Counsel, you're not challenging the jury instructions, are you?
No, not necessarily the jury instructions.
Okay, well, in fact, you didn't challenge them, did you?
I did not.
Okay. So therefore, if the court didn't err in instructing, and you're not challenging any significant evidentiary rulings, doesn't it simply just become an issue of fact for the jury?
It does become an issue of fact, and I think in this case...
And the jury unfortunately sided against your client, or I shouldn't say unfortunately, but they did decide against your client, right?
They did, and as we all know, sometimes juries get it wrong. They do not really understand what the definitions that were in the statute that were read as jury instructions, they may not completely understand what those consist of.
Well, given the fact that the jury found your client guilty of carrying a concealed weapon, what is the practical definition of it's in easy or on or about? What's the practical definition of that? Do you think that if you're carrying a concealed weapon in an automobile, you have to be able to reach the weapon while still maintaining one hand on the wheel?
If you're the driver, yes, that would be appropriate.
Well, where does it say that? If I can lean over and find the weapon in the passenger compartment of the car, why is that not easy reach?
If it's in the passenger compartment and it is within your reach, I think that's where, again, the state was getting to the issue with what is immediate. In this case,
isn't there a big difference between going down the highway at 60 miles an hour driving versus pulling over to the curve and your foot's on the brake and so essentially you're parked but you're still driving the vehicle? Isn't there a big difference between those two?
There is a difference, but again, if it's within your reach and you can actually reach over and grab it, that...
How do we know he couldn't have done that when he's pulled over to the curb?
I think then you have to look at the location of it. He was driving a U-Haul, so a larger vehicle. The location of it was within a hard-sided manufacturer's box. It was also placed basically as far away from him as possible in the vehicle.
What did the officer testify to as his opinion?
The officer testified that it was unreachable, that he could not have reached it while he was in the driver's seat. They didn't make any determination.
Counsel, didn't he say, the deputy said he couldn't reach it while driving. He never said anything about not reaching it from the seat. He went on to say while driving, correct?
He possibly didn't know exactly what the wording was. Again, even if he's not actively driving, he is on the side of the road, it's still technically outside of his reach. The issue that I'm concerned about is the expansion of what is going to be considered carrying a concealed weapon on or about. You know, if you're outside the reach of an individual, not even necessarily the driver, just another passenger in the vehicle, if you get to a point where, as long as it's in the passenger compartment.
Don't you get into cases then that are like the O.J. Simpson trials? Glove don't fit, you must acquit, and if you can't reach, you must retreat or whatever.
I don't have any good rhymes for this one, but it is a situation where you're going to have to look at the facts individually. I know the state and the dissent also brought up 28-12-12, where they talk about possession within the passenger's compartment of the vehicle. The problem with that statute is it's only used in four specific instances. They're all something of an enhanced circumstance where you have a weapon that's a stolen weapon, a base weapon, an individual who is a prohibited person, or you have a firearm that is regulated by the National Firearms Act, either a machine gun, short shotgun, short rifle. So the possession that they try to use in 1212 expands it under those circumstances. It's not in a situation like this where none of those apply.
Ultimately, doesn't this come down to a fact question decided by the jury?
It does come down to what the jury decided, but would you
wouldn't you say the Court of Appeals determination was they made a finding of fact that you couldn't reach it and therefore you couldn't be convicted of this? Is that their prerogative to do that?
I'm sorry?
Can they do that?
The Court of Appeals?
Make a finding of fact that is left to the jury?
Well, I think it's... What the jury found wasn't necessarily consistent with what the appellate court felt the law was. Just more of a misunderstanding by the jury on what the law was. They found, yes, that he was guilty.
But focusing on the assignment of error brought by the state as to what the Court of Appeals may have done wrong, what's your response? Was the analysis of the Court of Appeals consistent with our jurisprudence?
I believe it was. So we're in a situation where the firearm was... Yeah, outside of his reach. We're in a situation where there's going to be, if this is allowed to stand as a conviction, there's going to be an expansion of what is considered carrying a concealed weapon.
Well, is that an onerous burden upon people who are carrying weapons in their car to have them out, open, and obvious if they don't want to be convicted of carrying a concealed weapon as opposed to sticking it under the seat? Tucking it in the corner of the passenger side?
Oh, but when I was thinking about this, this kind of came up this weekend. The past weekend was opening pheasant hunting season. I was pheasant hunting, had my shotgun in a case in the back of my SUV. It's the same situation. That under the facts that were laid out in the case against Joseph Stent, those same facts could be used and I could be found guilty of carrying a concealed weapon. And with it being a shotgun rather than a handgun, you're not protected by a concealed carry permit or anything like that. So you're in a situation where, under what this jury found, it's expanded enough.
So you have your shotgun in the back seat, and what's concealed about that? I mean, you got it under clothing and stuff?
It was within a case, and I think there was a hunting vest on top of it. Basically the same situation. It was just outside my reach.
What if your arms had been longer? And are you advocating that we adopt a rule that basically depends on how long the defendant's arms are?
Well, not necessarily something where you're going to reach a defendant, but I think in this case, where you have a deputy specifically saying it is outside the reach of the driver, you can take that evidence and use that as the fact that it was outside of the reach. Not necessarily that you're going to measure it, you know, somebody that's 6'8" is going to have a longer reach than somebody 5'5". But again, that's what we're talking about. It's an immediate reach.
Counsel, if you stopped the car and slid over, could you have reached it?
He would have had to stop, unbuckle the seatbelt, slide over, retrieve it from behind the seat, take it out of the case, and then he would have had access to it.
How's that different than Stavey Goodwin, where we had to unlock the glove box to get the gun out?
In that case, but again, this was a U-Haul, so it's a larger vehicle. In the case with Goodwin, all he had to do was reach over, unlock the glove box, and he had access to the firearm. So I understand Goodwin, they were talking about a two-step process. The problem I have with that is, what is a step? Who's going to define a step? We're going to have an exhaustive list of, if he shuts off the vehicle, is that a step? If he pulls over, is that a step? And how many steps do we have to do? Two-step, three-step, four-step? So there's even more so than trying to define, you know, what is someone's reach when you start talking about what is an individual step. It could be an expansive list that has really no end to it.
Haven't some states solved that problem by simply adopting the rule that if the gun is in the cab of the vehicle, it's on or about, and stopped all the, is it close enough, could you reach it, was it one step, two step? Wouldn't a simple rule be easier?
It would be easier, but it would basically outlaw transportation of a firearm in the state of Nebraska if it's in the cab of a vehicle. Like I said, I have an SUV, it doesn't have a trunk. I wouldn't be able to transport a firearm legally in Nebraska unless it was out in the open.
What's wrong with that?
Again, like I said, there's, you know, well, one of the big things, if you're leaving it out in the open, there's going to be a theft issue. If you pull into a parking lot, put it under your seat to hide it, now you're carrying it concealed, but you leave it out in the open, somebody walking by sees it and breaks in and steals it. I know that's a serious concern in the state as well. But we've just asked the court to affirm the decision of the appellate court in this case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day is In Re Guardian and Conservatorship of Kaiser.